My client load is so diverse. I am genuinely, heartfeltly, like, truly honoured for having such a diverse client load. It's the most beautiful, you know, working within diversity is honestly the most humbling and beautiful thing for somebody like me. I learn very much, you know, I learn very much from my clients as well.
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. So, welcome everybody. In today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Claire Betson, who's a counsellor, ADHD coach and consultant. Her practice, Neuro by Nature, embraces and accommodates people who are autistic and ADHD, and Claire herself is neurodivergent. Claire is a member of Therapy Growth Group, and we very much value her for her insights and her questions. I've invited Claire on today because she's always been very grounded about what she can do and her capacity as someone with AUDHD. And so she's done things her way. She's taken time to develop her counselling practice. And I just think that's so encouraging that I wanted to give her the space to tell her story. I think what Claire demonstrates is that you can develop your practice in your way and make a success of it. Claire was recently named as the winner of Dudley's Diversity in the Community Award, and respecting difference is a theme that is central to her work, which we'll be talking about some more today. Just to say, you can tell I've got a bit of a cold, so I'm sorry I'm a bit hoarse, but the most important thing is I'm going to give that space to Claire, and I won't be talking very much, so welcome, Claire.
Hi, Josephine. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you here. And let's start talking a little bit about your practice, because as I said in the intro, you offer a little bit more than just therapy, don't you? Can you tell us what you do and how it all came about?
I set up really just focusing on therapy, but I think throughout my training, the journey to become a therapist, should I say, there were things that weren't quite hitting the mark for me as an autistic and ADHD person. So I really wanted to look at ways of actually being accessible and to be able to do more and to offer more to people. So that's why I did a qualification in coaching as well, so that I could kind of bring in facets of that. Mentoring now, I do mentoring. So I trained in mentoring and I offer coaching to young people over the age of 11. And that was through my own personal experiences of having a child that couldn't attend school. And we really struggled with therapeutic interventions. So I really wanted to work. Everything I do works around empowerment. So I feel therapy is a great tool and it will always be my first and foremost. And some people in therapy reach empowerment themselves. I think for the neurodivergent community, I needed to be able to integrate other things that weren't CBT and DBT, but they were very visual, very practical ways of empowering somebody. So I went and did, you know, the mentoring and coaching, and then...
Yeah, because you also offer sort of consultancy, don't you? Because you see, like, you'll help parents who've perhaps got a child who's struggling with school, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that part of the work is something I really value, because it's parents being able to come to a space where they can really speak honestly about the things that are impacting them. But it doesn't just impact them, does it? It impacts their whole household. From having to re-parent myself as a neurodivergent person, parenting a neurodivergent child, it's been a three-year process. It's really taken me, I mean, I know my strapline is like not your typical, you know, play on the word neurotypical, but it's about giving parents the permission, if you like, to parent in a way that suits both themselves and their child, and that kind of recognition that they're not bad parents. This is a hard situation and it's often overlooked.
Yeah. I think that is really interesting to hear you use that word permission, because that really ties in, doesn't it, with this sense of you empowering people as well, because I think that's so central to who you are as a person, isn't it? It's about giving permission. And I think your journey has also been a lot about giving yourself permission as well, isn't it? Permission to be who you are and develop things your way, which I think is what really makes you stand out, isn't it? It seems really central to who you are as a person, actually, from what I know of you. So
yeah.
So tell me, how have you attracted people to your practice? Because I think this is the sort of really interesting sort of element of what you do. I think from my sort of perception and memory, because we've been working together for a couple of years now, you sort of moved into the sort of more sort of almost like volunteering and consultancy. And then gradually that's led to clients. Would that be the case? So tell us your story of how you've sort of begun to attract clients to your practice.
Well, I think the first thing was surrounding myself with cheerleaders and people that I felt safe with and could trust. And that came from therapy growth group. You know, if I hadn't have had that level of support, I remember my first time there meeting yourself and another therapist, and I was in burnout. And I think that really was the pinnacle. That really was the moment where both of you said, you have permission to breathe and just be and just do what you need. And I think that really underpinned then everything, because I had neurotypical therapists up until then, and that you had a neurodivergent therapist with you on that particular day. And I think just being told you have permission sounds like such a small word. And I know we've mentioned it a few times, but that really opened up that I have permission to be who I am as I make my way forward, and encourage other people to do the same.
I think that's the thing is, you know, obviously you've been in the group for a while now, and I think that's actually what we love about you, is that you are you, and you bring your perceptions and the way you see things, your perspective, to the group, and it's brilliant. And you often just, you know, put your finger on the pulse, I think, you know, you're able to ask someone a question or say something, and you know, that just really helps. And I think, you know, be more Claire. We want you to be Claire, because you bring this lovely, it's just your unique self to the table, don't you? And tell me about working with clients. Do you find that this really helps the clients as well? You know, this permission giving and empowering.
Yeah. I think one of my common catchphrases to clients, I think if you said, what phrase do you say over and over again to clients, you know, don't apologize. You have nothing to apologize for. It's fine. You know, I might have a client that's still in bed eating their cereal and they're apologizing. It's fine. If that's how you have to show up in order to show up, that's fine. And if I do, you know, with my mop of curly hair, if I rock up for a 8:30 appointment and my hair's still drying, that's fine. You know, that is absolutely fine. And it works, because I have to, what would you call it? I have to model what a day looks like. I have turned up in my big hoodie before and said, it's freezing, in order for me to be here, because I have chronic health conditions as well. I might be mentally able to work, but physically, maybe I need to wear my back brace. And I'll mention it to the client, wearing a back brace today because, you know, my fibromyalgia, or I've got a wrist strap or my hoodie. And I do it unapologetically so they can.
That's a really interesting insight, isn't it? And you sort of like attract people, don't you, who need that sort of support. You know, all your social media and stuff and your website, it's aimed at helping people, isn't it, who are neurodivergent. And I'd really love to hear, actually, because you do quite a lot of work in the community as well, don't you? And I think that's sort of like where you started, isn't it? So tell us a bit more about the sorts of things that you do in the community to work with people.
A neurodiversity ambassador for our local charity. It's called Bedazzled. And they work with young people, providing all sorts of services to like boost their mental health. But when we're looking at marginalized communities, we are looking at neurodivergence. We are looking at the LGBTQIA plus communities. We are looking at poverty because based in Dudley, Dudley is not a particularly affluent area. So people depend on these services, and to be invested in how they work with neurodivergence, because so many, you know, there's a lot of home-edded young people there, you know, and we say home-ed as though that's a choice, but we have to, you know, or I've had to come to understand, you know, going through it myself, home-ed sometimes a last resort. It isn't parents pulling out their kids out of school. Sometimes the schools aren't meeting the needs.
Yeah, it's sort of like they've got no choice in a sense. Well, they've got a choice, but it's a sort of Hobson's choice almost, where it doesn't feel like a choice. You've just got to home educate them.
Yeah.
So, and I think this it can be very difficult for children like that, can't it? Because, you know, again, they're very marginalised. They're not in the system because the system doesn't suit them. But that in itself can cause all sorts of sort of challenges, can't it? Challenges for parents as well.
Yeah.
I just think the thought of having to home educate my children, I don't know how people do it.
I don't.
Really don't.
I don't. And that's why I do this stuff, because over Christmas we took them to a fun centre and during the summer holidays, and that we run activities. And I do those things, you know, like I say, it's charitable. And and I do it because it was a conversation I had actually once with like a personal coach, and accessibility, and people speak a lot about that with therapy, don't they, in particular. And I struggled with the rules around money and my perception of money. And I try and make what I do as accessible as I can. I had to have a lot of talking to myself and, you know, coaches and things like that to understand that you can do charitable stuff, or you can do price stuff if your situation affords for it, and if your spoon level affords for it. And there's something about, I know it sounds really cliched, but that divide between those that have can and those that can't. Empowering parents, empowering young people, empowering the LGBTQ community as well. I think that's, if it's innate, like it's kind of innate in me. I like to give. If I can give, I will give.
But I think the really interesting thing about your story, though, is that the sort of like the charitable work and the private practice, they're not mutually exclusive, are they? Because I think you've got this lovely crossover in that, because of the work that you've done in your sort of diversity side, that has actually helped to attract paying clients to your practice as well, hasn't it? So I don't, I think we can sort of, you know, sort of think, oh, you know, I shouldn't be giving stuff away for free because we're not supposed, you know, we're supposed to respect ourselves. And then there's a part of you that's thinking, yeah, but I want to do this. I want to help these kids. And yet you've balanced it, haven't you? Because the two of them work together. You've attracted clients through that work that you've done, haven't you?
And
that's my perception of it, that it has worked for you. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Even yesterday when we had like the open house, and I'll tell you about that actually, about the room. So I have actually taken up a private therapy room based where I do the charity work, and reflecting coming onto the podcast, and Dama says, you know, reflecting about coming here. And I was like, you've got a room. Oh my goodness. I when I went into training, that was one thing that brought out my neurodivergence, as a story about the room. Yeah. So we were asked the question when we were studying, basically, how do you envisage being a therapist? You know, what?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, what's your end goal? And I was like, oh, yeah, private practice. And I want a room, and it's going to be bright and colourful. I want bean bags. I want weighted blankets. I want cushions. I want cuddly toys. I want bright pictures on the walls. And everybody, honestly, you could hear a pin drop. Everyone just looked at me, because everyone else had gone for, I don't know, quite clinical things.
Yeah.
So that was one of the, without knowing at the time, you know, before I got my ADHD and autism confirmed, this was a telltale sign. This was me having been through therapy in neurotypical practices and knowing that, hold on, but I want, you know, I was sat in the therapy room thinking, I just want to roll on the floor, or I just want to, can I put my feet on the chair? And
I need a blanket.
Have a blanket. And I thought, well, when I get my therapy room, And what I was actually doing in my head was creating the space that I need to thrive and be authentic. I knew that that's the kind of room I wanted. And only now have I just worked towards that, because there's parts of me that are so, I think you'd asked before about like my journey, and it has been slower because there are so many things that are so nuanced. I have to fully connect with something for it to be. I can't just do the do. There has to be a connection. Finally, I've got my room. I've got my comfy chairs. I'll have a bubble lamp in there. I've got a colourful background that I created. I've got weighted blankets. I've got lots of plushies and fidgets and Play-Doh and all sorts.
And that's for the adult. Seeing a photo of it. So you brought into being this room that you imagined back when you were a student.
Yeah.
And you've created this room of your dreams, really. And and this has come about through your connections with the voluntary organisation, with the charity.
Yeah, and yesterday, for example, as look at me on my tangents, we had an open day and people came in, and people from other sectors, and they were like, I didn't know you existed. And one person who's also trained to be a therapist who'd come in said, I wish I'd met you X amount of years ago, because this is what I need. This is what I needed. Yeah. And I'm saying, well, this is here now. This is this, you know, I feel like I've kind of arrived.
Yeah. It's a really big step, isn't it? And it feels like you're sort of stepping into this reality, really, of what you dreamed about. So congratulations.
Thank you.
It's really great, isn't it? Yeah, because it sort of reminds me, really, because, you know, before you came on, I sort of had a look to see when you joined Therapy Growth Group, and it appears to have been a couple of years ago. I don't know if that's what you think as well. And I think I remember you saying about a year ago, well, I've been here a year and haven't got any clients yet.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so lovely, actually, is that you've taken things at your pace, haven't you? And like you said, you've sort of, it feels like you have to embody stuff before you can move forward with it. Do you think that's the case with the fees as well? That sort of like, you know, the thought of charging for your work was something that you had to sort of get your head around before you were able to start.
Yeah, I think, and I just want to go back to embody stuff. I love that. That's like the nail on the head for me. That is exactly what I have to do. So if I can't be embodied in something, I'm detached. And the fees were one of those things. It was, you know, seeing other people's fees. I felt my fees for my area are quite high, ironically. But that also means that how I kind of operate is that on the higher price point, because I have my set price and people can pay more. If you want to pay more, you can pay more. And that subsidizes other people.
Sort of like paying it forward almost.
Yeah. The trap I fell into, though, was what I kind of call value added. And I think I might have bought it to Therapy Growth Group before, where the kind of things I was then doing was trying to prove my worth.
Yeah.
So you set a fee and then if I was paying X amount, this is what I would expect in return. I found fees really difficult to navigate.
I'd say it can be a really problematic, can't it? Because we're so aware of the value of stuff, and, you know, we bring what we would think is a reasonable value to something, forgetting that other people have completely different ideas about value. And quite often it's difficult for us to actually value what we're doing ourselves and think, well, it is worth, you know, if I just do this, it's actually worth it. You think, oh, I think I should do more.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely. And I came into, I didn't start, actually, considering I've been with you for, I think it's about 2.5 years, I didn't start taking clients until June or July time, 2025. So everything was so slow. And the fees side of it was just one of those things that, and I think I said to you, I think a question may have been asked about how many clients would be your ideal amount. And mine was six. If I had six clients, I'd be happy. I started in, like I said, June or July, and I think I have 20 clients.
It's a bit different to six.
it's very different to six, and it's not what I imagined.
Yeah, so I think you begin to move then into another sort of zone, don't you, which is how do I handle the demand?
Yeah.
Because it actually, you know, and the thing is I would just say that during that time where you weren't seeing clients, you were still, you know, you were present, you were attending all the meetings, you were learning, and not only that, but you were building relationships in the community. So yeah. I think when you finally sort of said, yes, I'm taking clients, it's sort of like, woof, there's lots of people sort of waiting for you to open up.
The first time when I set up the Facebook page, I set up with no intention of taking clients, and it was a Sunday, and I think I had 3 inquiries through Facebook. I hadn't advertised. In fact, I didn't advertise on BACP or Counselling Directory, I don't think, until September. But when I'd opened up the Facebook page, and that's a good year and a half ago.
I can remember that happening, and you say, I don't think I'm ready to take them on. You know?
I couldn't do it. I had a block. I got the first message through, the first request, and I was like, I mean, luckily it was a Sunday, so I put that back. I'm not replying till Monday.
Yeah.
As that Sunday went on, there were 2 more, and I just went into panic mode. It was such a real thing.
And you said no, didn't you? You decided not to take them on.
I said I wasn't ready. I'm setting this up, and when I am ready, you know, you'll know. But I just wanted to get the page set up. I wanted to get, like you said, that embodiment. So it was like a gestation period, if you like.
Yeah.
And I needed that before I could actually do the work.
Yeah, I think it's just really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, there's that sort of pressure. And I think you were very courageous to say, no, I'm going to wait because I know this is not the right time for me. And I wonder, because there's sort of a parallel here really with when you won your award as well. So back in, was it November, you were someone nominated you to win the Diversity in the Community Award for Dudley.
Yeah.
And you went along to the event not expecting to win, and you won, didn't you?
yeah.
And then, because we knew you were going, and then it went very quiet.
Yes.
Tell us about the process and what it was like for you. I mean, you know, congratulations on getting the award, and it's very well deserved. But what happened, you know, when you got the award? What was the process like for you?
You know, there was the story with the dress, which I'd taken to Therapy Growth Group, about how I bought a dress in a charity shop just because it was all shiny and beautiful. And I love vintage and retro. So I like researching stuff. And this dress was like couture, and it was a ridiculous price. It was like £3 instead of 6. And it was like, I just need it. I don't have a need for it, but I need it. I need to be able to look at it and feel it and touch it. And I've got nowhere to wear it. But if ever I get a red carpet event, I'm wearing that dress. And then the red carpet event came, and it was like,
oh, tell us about your footwear.
Oh, yeah. But because I only wear Crocs and Dots, literally, there was no way I was wearing heels because it had all. So I wore my sparkly Crocs underneath.
Fantastic.
I seem to have to like clarify, if you like, everything.
Yeah.
So I am in my comfort zone. I didn't understand some of the language in the invite, something about, what was it?
Oh, yeah, carriages at midnight, wasn't it? And you said, what does that mean?
yeah. I had to bring it and ask the question because I, again, very literally, I genuinely thought that at midnight there was going to be some kind of parade. I thought there was, you know, and so my head was like, what kind? And I don't always think to, like, Google stuff, or I just think, well, everyone.
I think it's... It's so interesting from a diversity point of view, isn't it? That they hadn't considered that carriages at midnight is something that just doesn't mean anything.
No.
You know, if you know, you know. But if you don't, what the hell is that about?
Yeah.
Really so that interesting.
Was, very bizarre. And then when we were sat there and they brought my thing up on the screen and I just cringed. My head went down. I went in my imposter syndrome, just that, you know, that kind of ick you get when you're on a big screen. And then I was there with my son and daughter, and then they announced the winner, and I just thought they'd accidentally slid back on the screen and brought my picture up again. And I sat there honestly for a good 10 seconds, and my son
not really.
Didn't go in. And then like you said, I went quite, I won the brilliant, lovely, very proud moment.
Did your son and daughter have to tell you to go up there then?
They did, because they called it, and I just sat there, and I think Amari, my son, he said, "Mom, it's you." And I said, "No, it's not." And I felt embarrassed because I was like, "Amari, it's not," because I slid the slide back. And then my daughter, she was like, "Mom, it's you. You need to go up." And I was like, "No, I don't." She was like, "It's you." And I said, "It's not." And I looked and they were waiting for me.
Oh. I was like, and it is me.
Yeah, it is. And even in the pictures, you can see my head. There's just this whole discomfort with the, you know, because you speak a lot about it, actually, Josephine, the celebrating our achievements.
Yeah.
And it's not something I think us as therapists and these kind of roles, we don't do that, do we?
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of like, it's a very exposing thing, actually, isn't it? When you're sort of publicly celebrated like that and in front of a room full of strangers, spotlight's on you, isn't it? And... well, for all sorts of reasons, we might actually not like the spotlight being on us a lot of the time, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had to go up and accept the award.
Yeah. And it was just very, the thing I think that kept me going, and it sounds really cliched, but it genuinely was the level of pride that my son and daughter had in me. They were
delighted.
Yeah. And you know, the next day it was like, "Oh, you won the award." You know, it was like a little bit of a joke. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I forgot." You know, because because the discomfort I felt as an autistic person, you know, all of my senses are triggered at once. And I needed, after winning that award, I needed downtime. It took so much out of me. And if you don't understand, say, the nuances of autism and ADHD, it sounds really over the top. Like I should be shouting it from the rooftops. I should be really excited. But I kind of went into...
You had to go and hide, in a sense.
Yeah, I went and hid. And I think I brought it to Therapy Growth Group. And I didn't know what to do. What do I do now? What do people do when they win an award? And I hadn't even posted it on my socials. You know, this being present and being seen and being celebrated is so far removed from... the messages I received as a person growing up and as a young adult, believe it or not, I had to overcome that.
Because presumably being seen in the past could have led to danger. So to be seen brings up that nervous system reaction, doesn't it? You know, it's not safe for me to be seen.
And when you win an award for like diversity as well, and we know how toxic places can be. We know what diversity means, and the wording of the award, which I can't recall, but when it explained why the person that wins it, i.e. me, would win that award, you just know that when it's out there, I don't know, say on social media and stuff, say the more local, your local newspapers and this and that, the kind of insults and things and the people that don't
sort of get it.
And the narratives that run around disability and neurodivergence and LGBTQ and just difference in general. Yes.
So there was a fear there for you as well about, you know, what people would say and think. Mm. And also, I mean, I hope it's okay to bring this in, but you've talked about being mixed race as well, haven't you? We'll move on to talk a little bit about lovely animation you've got on your Instagram.
Yeah.
But do you think sort of being mixed race was part of that as well, in that, you know, that sort of almost that sense of you don't belong? Because often if you're mixed race, it's like, well, you don't belong because you're not white, but you don't belong because you're not black. Yeah. And do you think there's almost like that sort of element of you don't belong, you know, you shouldn't be winning this award because you're not somebody who belongs? I don't know if that's part of it as well.
No, it was. And that was part as well of the whole setting up. I remember the conversations I'd had, I think with yourself, actually, Josephine, or within the group, about my fear of being seen as a mixed race,
and
queer, neurodivergent person, where I couldn't see that. And I hadn't learned about black people in my counselling course. You know, you learn about Freud and you learn. So I hadn't, I was stepping into a world where I couldn't see myself in it. Through all my years of therapy, I've been in therapy on and off since age 9. I haven't seen black or mixed racist or brown. I haven't seen like a global majority therapist. And when you consider the kind of things I was in therapy for, I didn't see somebody like me.
Yeah, that's why it's so helpful that you are a therapist now as well. So, you know, you are breaking that mold of, you know, this sort of middle-aged white person type therapist. But yeah, to not have that, it's sort of like, you know, with the best will in the world, and we can try and, you know, educate ourselves as white people on diversity experience, but it's just not the same as having a therapist there who gets it.
Yeah.
And that sense of, yeah, I understand what it's like to be in your situation and to be in this sort of family setup, or, you know, perhaps, I don't know what your situation was, but, you know, one of the only kids in the school perhaps who's mixed race or whatever.
Yeah. And you had Yvonne Guest on one of your podcasts, didn't you? And, you know, very much of what they said resonated. And it's nice to see the work that they're doing as well.
Yeah. To sort of highlight it.
And I see it within my own therapy practice. You know, I know we've had some difficult times regarding just the general discourse, but when I have people from Black, you know, and brown and the LGBT community, and some of my, what are they called? When somebody reaches out for therapy, some of them are actually saying, you know, people are coming to therapy due to racism and fascism and fear of the flags, or fear of harassment, racial harassment at work, or people of mixed identities who are worried about, you know, their the way they communicate. And it's nice.
There's so much fear.
It's nice to be sought out for that. And some people are very open about it. You were one of the only Black faces that I saw when I scrolled through, you know, wherever.
It's so important, isn't it? It's so important to have that representation within the counselling profession. And, you know, I hate to say it, but unless, as white therapists, we actually address the problem and actually talk, you know, I've done an episode on, you know, writing an inclusion statement, in that, you know, Black and brown people, they won't know whether we're safe. You know, as white therapists, are we safe to work with, or are we out there, you know, putting a flag on a lamppost? You know, you just don't know, do you? And so you need, you know, we need sort of, as you say, people from the global majority to be therapists.
And when it comes especially as well to autism and ADHD and neurodivergence, when we put that in a package, our voices, you know, aren't amplified. It will only be, you know, so I kind of don't lean towards influencing or having a presence. I just do my little bits that I can do, because some of the platforms and, you know, and people that speak the loudest.
And you need to sort of like look after yourself, don't you, as well? Like you say, there's when you talk about diversity and winning the award, what the reaction might be, and, you know, mixed race, woman, ADHD, that there can be a lot of people coming back about that, can't there? Unfortunately, on our social media, it's really prevalent. Have you had anything like that sort of coming up on your feeds or anything? Or because I'm trying to think if you do put your face on your feeds, I think you do, don't you? But yeah, have you had any negative commentary or
managed
to avoid that so far?
No, yeah. I haven't so far. I know that again was something like putting my face to my brand, but again, I'm so visual, and many people when looking for a therapist like to see what the person looks like prior.
Yeah,
like it's an important way to engage, really, isn't it? I think it is important, and many people, yourself included, have said that the people that want you are the ones that will find you because of your presence. And my client load is so diverse. I am genuinely, heartfeltly, like truly honoured for having such a diverse client load. It's the most beautiful, you know, working within diversity is honestly the most humbling and beautiful thing for somebody like me. I learn very much, you know, I learn very much from my clients as well.
Yeah, so are you sort of not just seeing people who are like neurodivergent, you're seeing, you know, people who might be sort of diverse in other areas. So like you say, LGBTQ or disability, that sort of thing.
But they're all neurodivergent as well. You know, most people, I see neurotypical people, and I feel that the way that I practice practice helps. It's hard to explain. It's like I did my studying so I could get my piece of paper and so I could find out what the rules are and then find ways to work outside the box, if you like. I'll explain to people, you know, and I've had neurotypical people, like I said, and it's like, if you need a break, we'll have a break. You know, you're welcome to have a break. Or if you want to roll on the floor, you can roll on the floor. Or would you like to use visuals, you know, so we'll have cards or the whiteboard or the Russian dolls, you know. So it's about, like I said, when it's empowerment, we do everything together that we can. To get to that, I think when you reach authenticity, that's when empowerment comes.
Exactly. It's helping people reach that. And you work in different ways to enable people to get there in their own way. So it might be like through creative means, for example, if that's the way that it's going to unlock that part of themselves.
And I like to say to people that, you know, I'm here to kind of look at your blind spot. You know, you're there central and integral. And I'm just here to like bring attention to those spots that maybe you're not connecting with. I've done longer sessions, I've done shorter sessions, and I think I've even got a clause on my website, maybe, you know, that whatever that person, that client needs, I will accommodate as long as it's within my ethical body's guidance and insurance, you know. You know, I work with a young person and that might involve go into the local park and feeding the ducks, and you know, other people it will be online, other people it will be face to face on the phone.
It depends what they need, and you're sort of like responding to that need to allow them to unlock that part themselves. I wondered if we could just, as I've mentioned it, just quickly touch on, because you've got an animated poem on your Instagram, haven't you? Tell us a little bit about that.
That poem came about, I wrote that very long time ago. It's probably almost vintage. And it came when I was starting to get back in touch with my dad. My dad died of a brain tumor. My dad's black, my mum's white. Mm-hmm. And when I got in touch with my dad, and I was able to then, going back to the words, you know, I had permission to have a black side, to be mixed race, to be, I had a way of looking at my authenticity. I had nurturing that was aligned with me being, you know, black mixed person. Mm-hmm. And I wrote that poem when I was working in schools, funny enough, because I'd read it to some kids. And that was about my identity. Because the thing with me is that my identity has always been so always a game of two halves. You know, I have to be black and white, you know, autistic and ADHD. And the list goes on and on. That poem back then was part of my own self-acceptance of what it means to be mixed race and how I struggled and how mixed identities do struggle and can struggle. And that, you know, the overarching thing of the poem and the animation is that I was happy just to be me. That when we take away the words of black, white, autistic, ADHD, when we take away all those labels, you're still just left with what I embody, and that's me. And that's what therapy does a lot, you know, neurodivergent and otherwise, getting people to get comfortable with themselves.
It's really interesting, and that's sort of what you've been bringing to people. And I wonder if I could bring something in here. We can cut it out if you don't want to answer. But I remember you telling me about you'd had EMDR, and the EMDR sort of took the trauma away, didn't it? And then it actually left you sort of feeling, well, who am I now? Because it was sort of like, because you were almost traumatized, Claire, weren't you? And when you had the EMDR and it took the trauma away, it sort of left you sort of in a sense without some identity, didn't it? I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about that.
No, thanks for reminding me about that as well, because funny enough, yesterday I found my EMDR journal. I didn't really look through it, and I will go and look through it now off the back of this. But the EMDR, I think when you've been through so much trauma, so much significant trauma, and the kind of traumas I've been through have been, what would you call them, significant and reoccurring. So, you know, I've had so many pockets of trauma and then having not healed from one into another. And it's almost like it became my identity. It made me up. There was like, you know, like a mosaic, I guess. They're all the pieces.
It's a part of your personality.
Yeah. And the EMDR, I mean, I'd worked as a psychologist for years through the NHS, and he was fantastic. And I saw him years ago for a long period of time, maybe 4.5 years. So we'd done the trauma work. I felt very safe with him because he knew the traumas. And then the question becomes, can you whittle it down to 3 that we can work on for the next year? And you're like, 3? Oh! But
if you've got more than that, yeah.
Yeah, but the 3 that we worked on really shifted. It felt like it erased, you know, some of my responses, and it left me feeling, well, don't have the trauma anymore. What now? What do I have? It's so hard to try and quantify it, because it's not like I'm playing a martyr and saying that I needed the traumas, but it's like saying I found it difficult to, say, be in a pub because the noise and the amount of people, I would always feel unsafe because unsafe things had happened around alcohol for me.
Yeah.
And when you take that away, and I could go into a pub that was crowded and not feel fear. So because I'm no longer feeling the fear, I'd stand there and think, well, what am I feeling? This feels odd. When I normally come to a pub, I don't feel this, I don't know, alert or present.
Yeah.
So it kind of gave me presence. I think that'd be the right way of terming it.
Yeah.
Presence in areas of my life where I maybe hadn't been present because the trauma had affected my parenting. And I think taking away with the EMDR, minimizing and putting those traumatic memories back where they needed to be, it helped me to be more present in my parenting. And it was like, oh, I'm not getting so, I don't know, irritated because my son's shouting at me. What do I do?
It's almost like, it's like you had to relearn what your responses would be. You had to sort of like, it's like meeting a new situation because you hadn't been in that place before.
And when the nightmares went, and it would be like, oh, you know, like months later, I think, I didn't have that nightmare again.
Yeah.
You know, or somebody might mention a certain person or a certain thing, and wherever I would get a particular reaction, I was then having to recall that person. Whereas they'd be at the front of my brain, you could say a name and I would know the person.
Yeah, instantly, yeah.
Instantly. Now it'd be like, you could say the name and I have no instantaneous response. And also, again, to add with the EMDR and how you can make that more neuro-friendly, you know. So when I had EMDR initially, it was the finger. I had to say to myself, I can't follow it.
Yeah.
Could not concentrate on it. So he introduced tapping, like drumming.
Yeah.
And he'd do it with me. And it was brilliant because I got my movement and rhythm. So then he got carpal tunnel. So he couldn't do the tapping with me anymore. So then we went on to the buzz thingies. So even things like EMDR can be
sort of like adapted.
Adapted to help neurodivergent people, but also, you know, I my wrist would hurt as well. But so it was those things.
Really, really fascinating. And I hope that's sort of like little bit of insight there for people who are doing EMDR with their clients, because it's sort of really interesting to hear sort of how it left you at the end. So absolutely fascinating. Let me we're just sort of coming to the end now, so I just wanted to sort of finish off with a few questions. What would you want other neurodivergent therapists to hear if they're sort of worried that they're doing things too slowly or that they're finding it difficult to sort of embody the changes that they need to make their private practice work?
Your private practice is private to you, and that takes into account who you are as a person. Surround yourself with the right people who can nurture you and fully understand you without judgment, who can be your cheerleaders. And, you know, I've learned a couple of tricks. So when my ADHD is in full blown. Yes, I want to do all the shiny things. And, you know, a charity or a business will ask me something so I can buy myself time and really think about it. I always say, I will speak to my supervisor and get back to you. So I've got like a pause button I can press to allow me that time to think. Whether I speak to my supervisor or not is different. But
you've got it there in your back pocket so you can take a pause. Yeah.
And it also demonstrates to other people as well that I have, there's more than just me. I do have people around me. The other thing that was really vital to me, and touch wood, luckily I haven't used it yet, was preparing for burnout. And actually preparing for what might happen with, you know, having your contract, like my coach explained to me, have that thing in your contract that says, you know, due to chronic health or due to neurodivergence, there may be times unfortunate. So you've got that get out clause.
That's really helpful for people. Yeah. Go on.
You know, my fear was, one of the fears, I think, and maybe it applies to everyone, neurodivergent or not, but what if it goes wrong? So I actually have a plan to manage my burnout. So I asked myself the questions, how will I know that things have become too much and maybe I'm deteriorating? What can I do? And I reflected on that and I put a plan together. So I have now, I have myself a burnout plan. And I also created myself a burnout box, which I'll discuss another time, no doubt, in a post or something, where if I feel that I'm reaching burnout, I've created a box for me to manage my burnout. But it is important to recognize the signs and don't push through. Don't, if you cannot push through, you know, make sure you have a good supervisor, you know, and support systems. But you know, it sounds really bad to say prepare for the worst, but I feel like once we've prepared for it, we can put it out the way and hope we don't need to use it.
And it is a reality for neurodivergent people that you can hit this neurodivergent burnout, isn't it? And it's important to accommodate yourself, really, and look after you.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can continue to look after your clients. Yeah. And do you think there's any myths you'd like to challenge, you know, about the way private practice should be done or, you know, what private practice is, anything like that?
Yeah. So one of my bugbears when I was setting up private practice was seeing what other people were doing. Too much information can be too much information, literally.
Yeah.
You can get so bogged down with things. I've seen conversations about, can I drink in front of my clients? Can I offer my clients a drink? What kind of chair should I sit in? What kind of clothes shall I wear? Can I wear this? Can I do that? And I think as long as you're abiding by your ethical practice, the rest is what you feel you should do, because I can only show up as myself. I can't show up as somebody else. And I know Josephine has said it to me before, the right clients find the right therapist, the right time. So if a client would be offended by me drinking, then maybe it's not the right client for me.
Yeah.
You know,
I hasten to add, not drinking alcohol, just drinking a cup of tea or something like that.
Yeah, a cup of tea. You know, fundamentally, within any kind of therapeutic background, we're told to show up authentically. And then we go and put these rules and regulations around what authenticity looks like.
That's not authentic.
My role means so much to me because I can do it authentically.
Yeah.
If I have to be somebody else to do this role, I can't do it. And that plays into my neurodivergence. It plays into a lifetime of becoming the person I am and also wanting my clients to follow through on that journey of becoming who they want or need to be. So I have to model that.
Yeah, I think that's very profound, actually, Claire. It's sort of like, you know, I've moved into being me and this is what I want for my clients, is for them to move into being themselves as well. And it's part of our journey. You know, it's part of what I'm doing in the world, and hopefully that's something that enables them to be who they are in the world as well.
Yeah.
And in a world that can be quite hostile towards people who are diverse in different sorts of ways. Claire, so how can people find you? What's the best way of people getting in touch?
Strangely, but also in keeping my boundaries and keeping my measurements, I don't have a contact phone number. And that again was a boundary that I had to put in place because I know me, not because of my clients, but because I know how I would be. So everything I do is, you know, contactable through online. So I've got my website, and that's neurobynaturetherapy.co.uk. I'm on Instagram and Facebook under neurobynaturetherapy. I have a local group, but it's for local people, which is ADHD and Autism Connect in Stourbridge.
Yeah.
And that's for local people.
Yeah. But if people want to look you up, your website, neurobynaturetherapy.co.uk, and neurobynaturetherapy on Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah.
And I do recommend that you have a look at Claire's posts because they're very clear. They're lovely. You know, we haven't had a chance to talk about your Instagram, but they're very much coming from that place, aren't they, of this is what it's like to be neurodivergent. Like, you know, you talk about, we're just recording this in January, so what it's like for neurodivergent kids to go to see Santa, you know, that sort of stuff to help people understand more about neurodivergence and to know that they're accepted as they are.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Claire, for coming along. I know we could talk for so much longer, but...
Yeah. No, thank you, Josephine.
Have you back in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks
for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.